The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
The economic data is so good this week, it's almost bad.
Yield spike, stocks dive. New security concerns thrash semiconductor companies. And we have two great guests today. Daniel Prince, who's the head of iShares Product Consulting at BlackRock. And CPA Patrick Camuso joins us talking taxes. All this and much more on episode number 582 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. And hello, good day, and welcome. This is Andrew Horowitz, and you're listening to the Disciplined Investor Podcast. It's now the first week of October, thoroughly in the record books, 2018. And it started out okay, and then quickly got off to some rough footing there as we saw that there was some concern about a variety of different things that are cropping up and getting into earnings season and worries about some of the warnings that we're seeing from some companies, the rolling over of the housing market in terms of builders, specifically builders. We talked about that last week. And on top of that, we saw rates just move up throughout the week incredibly, especially right after we saw that employment number on Wednesday from ADP, which came out much greater than expectations. And that followed along into Thursday and Friday when we saw that even though there was a significant miss on the number itself from the employment standpoint, expecting somewhere around about 180,000 or so on Friday added to the payrolls, and we got, in the 130s? And, at first glance, you're like, slowing down, and what's going on there? But the unemployment rate went to 3.7%. And more importantly, and probably the most important, did you see those revisions from the last couple of months adding, I think it was almost 80,000 jobs after the revisions and all the cleanups were made? I mean, that's pretty spectacular. What else are you going to say? Those are really good numbers from the employment front. And when you put that together with all the other components that you see within that particular report on Friday, you saw there's some wage gains that continue on. Yes, the idea that inflation is creeping in more jobs. I mean, clearly the jobs number is a proxy in a way for the inflation number. The more people that are working, the more people that are on the payrolls, the more people that are brought in means there's going to be some wage pressure. When you get to the levels that we've seen now, which is back to where it was back in 1969, the last time we saw a 3.7% unemployment rate. Pretty impressive. And if anybody's going to tell us, there's no inflation, man, nothing out there, no. Come on. We all know better than that. Even though Powell was out late last week with some discussion on a Sunday night that, right before the markets opened on the futures side last week, not this week, but last week, we're not so worried about inflation. There is inflation in the system. You can't talk your way out of it at this point, particularly because we've had all these different incentives and programs and stimulus that's been brought into the system over the last number of years, consistent with the low interest rates that we saw, all the various federal programs, the lower taxes that we saw, the lower regulatory environment, all kicking up investor, corporate, and consumer confidence. Therefore, what that's doing is it's really starting to pressure the economy in a good way. So now on one hand, you say, all these things are good. And they are. There's no question that all these things are good. But the result on the back end of this may be an overheating economy. Now, maybe it's not today. Maybe it's not tomorrow. But something is obviously percolating enough that we're seeing a very significant move in yields, particularly the long yield. Now, the Fed doesn't work with the long yields, right? They work with the short yields. the shortest part of the yield curve. The Fed funds rate, that's what they control. Now, some things kick off from that and are impacted by that. But still, you realize something, that the longer part of the curve is a bit, I wouldn't say independent, but not as reliant on the Fed. And that whole part of the curve is picking up dramatically. Now, part of that could be, and some people are speculating, saying, hey, you know what, maybe, this is the Chinese who are really slowing down on their bond purchases. They went to the lowest in 4 or 5 months of purchases, and there's some concern that maybe they'll really start to slow down on their purchases, hold what they have, but not renew as things roll off. And then who's going to be the incremental buyer then? Now, there's only so much they can do to, you know, they have some trade balance they need to deal with here and their currency issues. A lot of things that go into play here. They can't just, you know, stop or sell all of their bonds. It would be real detrimental to them as well. So we're tied up in this game together. But they can try to do something like they've done possibly to combat some of the trade war that's being pushed right in their face. This, you know, maybe try to get the heel off the throat a little bit when it comes to some of this trade issues. I don't think that's necessarily the case. I do think that it is the realization by many of the players in the bond market that, hey, you know what? Rates are going up. They're probably not going to stop very soon. The Fed clearly signaled that they're a little towards the hawkish side of things in their most recent rate announcement and Powell's discussion. Reading between the lines, you can really see there is some hawkishness there, considering that we'll see another rate increase in December and probably 2 to 3 more in 2019, all things being equal. Now, I don't know if the markets fall out of bed, will the Fed all of a sudden say, no, oh, no, no, we're slowing down. You know, we see what's happening with the economy, but you got to be careful. You can't talk out of two sides of your mouth here. If the economy stays very strong, but markets are going down, and all of a sudden they say that they're going to slow down on their rate hike process, they could lose some, you know, have some confidence lost in what they do. So, interesting balancing act that's going to go on right there. Anyway, we have some things to talk about, probably get into it a little bit deeper next week. We'll see how this all plays out with yields, some of the new security concerns regarding the semiconductor companies and this chip that supposedly was implanted in the chips of Apple and, I don't know, 3 or 4 different companies. And those companies are taking a beating, and so is the semiconductor sector entirely. But we'll get to that. But I want to get with our guests because there's a couple of things going on in the markets right now and towards the end of the year, right where we are right now, with regard to taxes, that I want to talk to a CPA and cover a couple of areas. I have a list of questions specific to the end of the year and a few things that are probably going to matter and things we need to be aware of. So get your pencils and papers ready, or your notepad ready, or your, you know, whatever device you do to keep notes. We'll hopefully answer a lot of things that you have to really be aware of for the end of the year. And I want to talk about the global industry classification standard changes that were recently implemented and how that impacts you as an investor. So let's get right into that topic right now. And our guest today is from BlackRock. His name is Daniel Prince, and he is the head of iShares Product Consulting for the BlackRock's U.S. Wealth Advisory and their iShares business. And he does a bunch of research and delivering a product analysis and insights to clients and partners. And also, we got a big guy, big gun. Daniel, how are you?
I'm doing well, Andrew. Thank you. How are you?
I'm good. So, you know, one of the things that you and I spoke about earlier was something that has been on the mind of a lot of investors lately, because last week or so there was this announcement. Well, the announcement was a while ago, but the actual implementation of this GICS sector changes, the Global Industry Classification Standards. And there was a swapping around of different stocks inside of funds, and Facebook was going here and Amazon was staying there. And can you kind of take us through what happened?
Yeah, absolutely. So at the end of September, as you mentioned, GICS, sort of the how you classify securities from a sector perspective, or one of the ways you classify securities from a sector perspective, really changed, and really was a landmark change for them, how they view certain sectors. Notably, there was a sector formerly called telecom that has been now evolved into a communication sector and sort of broadened and widened the scope there. There's also been some movement from stocks that were formerly classified as technology. You mentioned Facebook, Google were traditionally labeled as technology sectors per GICS, then moved into the communication sector. So one of the biggest changes that GICS has made from a sector classification occurred at the end of September here.
So, but the biggest part was, I mean, consumer staples didn't change, right? You know, we didn't see much going on there. Consumer discretionary. Well, actually, Amazon was in consumer discretionary, wasn't it?
Yeah, there was a few names out of consumer discretionary that were moved over into the new communications sector. So firms like Disney were moved over into the new communication services. So really, when you take a step back and think about the impact, there was three main sectors that were impacted. Some names from consumer discretionary moved over to communications, and some names from technology moved over to communications. Again, really broadened out what was formerly telecom to be this new communications sector.
So let's take this from the aspect of how this was implemented. So now we have this notion that there's going to be a change. And whoever is in charge, I guess it was S&P, right? They're in charge of these GICS, and they reformulate their indices, and they come up with this new sector or the expanded sector. And now all of a sudden, what has to happen from whether it's a mutual fund or maybe even a hedge fund or an ETF, there has to be now some movement from, let's say, if Facebook is going to move from technology over to the communications, there has to be a kind of a, I don't know if you do it internally or what happens, but this kind of redevelopment of that index, right?
Yeah, there's really two different effects downstream here. One is much ado about nothing, actually. So if you invest broadly, and let's just say you buy the S&P 500, there's no mandate on what the sector composition needs to be. It is just a simple, you know, what is elected as the 500 top stocks in the U.S. as per S&P. That is actually not changing. Right. How we classify the companies within is changing. So at one level, and we find most clients are at this level, it's actually these changes mean nothing. Right. But if you do invest using sectors, so you are buying a telecom, whether it's a mutual fund, index mutual fund, or an ETF, or you are buying a technology ETF or mutual fund, that's where you're going to see the changes because your overall exposure is going to change. So stocks need to be removed to go to the new sector and vice versa. So that's the level where clients need to think about their impact.
So but from some of the research that I looked at, it seemed to me that Facebook, not of course in the S&P 500, but within the sector funds, was going to actually have a reduced exposure in its entirety. Whereas it was a certain percent of one, it's going to be a lower percent. Maybe dollar for dollar that didn't change, but I thought there was some kind of a reduction for a few stocks in the actual holdings that could have, you know, precipitated a bit of a selling necessity. Is that not true?
Yeah. That is true. So, you know, if let's just go to the example of a tech fund that was holding Facebook before and after this classification needs to get reorganized. You know, when you look at a certain fund, it's all about how the market cap is distributed. So it could be the case, and it could work both ways. It could have increased its weight or reduced its weight. When securities moved over to the new sector, they are now relative to their new peers, if you will, within that sector. So you could see some weight differences at the different sector level, but all their market cap will be accounted for relative to their peers. Where I think the press really picked up on, you know, the turnover that was occurring was, you know, there's a lot of large ETFs that are technology focused that needed to remove these names. So like think about the giants like Facebook and Google need to be removed from the technology sector ETF and into the new communication. You're going to see buying and selling and turnover in order to migrate those names into different funds.
So how did that impact, for example, some of the potential for capital gains? So using the example of Facebook, and if obviously, if Facebook was a core holding, let's say, of the tech sector fund for some time, and there's a lot of investment in there, and all of a sudden it has to be sold, possibly for a significant gain because it held it, you know, for a very long time, even though there's buying and selling that goes on all the time, was there, Do you think there's going to be additional flow-throughs of some kind of gains?
Yeah, I mean, generally when you think about turnover, you know, we always sort of put it in the camp of, you know, relative towards tax efficiency. Like, are you going to realize capital gains or not? And I think one thing to put into light is, you know, the efficiency of the ETF structure.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the fact that ETFs are generally created and redeemed in kind, meaning you swap securities in kind as opposed to selling, really eliminates some of the gains that could be realized in a portfolio.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you sort of think about what is a really efficient structure for handling big rebalance like this, I think there's no better structure than ETFs to handle this. And in fact, I think a lot of the rebalance activity will have been done. And, you know, we will find out when capital gains come out in the latter part of the year, how tax efficient the ETF wrapper can be for these rebalances. But if there's going to be rebalances of this nature, the ETF structure is really well equipped to handle this and minimize the tax impact.
As opposed to if the exact same thing happened in a mutual fund, the impact could have been very dramatic in that they're required to pass through, was it 90% of their gains to the client by the end of the year. Therefore, any built-up gains that happened that were unrealized up until this, and if it was a quote-unquote tech fund that mirrored the tech GIC classification, they could possibly have created a substantial capital gain involved in this, right?
Yeah, I think all else equal, you know, relative towards ETFs, you know, a mutual fund would have to do more buying and selling. So you could see some differences there. Probably not prudent for me to speculate the magnitude. You know, I don't handle those portfolios
right.
And don't see the numbers. So I'm going to stick to sort of what I know.
Right.
But I will say, though, all else equal, you know, the ETF wrapper, if you will, if I can call it a wrapper, will sort of create more efficiencies by not having to buy and sell and simply removing securities in kind. I think this brings up a great point as we head into fourth quarter. Around this is the time of year that clients really see the tax efficiency of ETFs when they get their capital gain estimates and realize, you know, on the whole that ETFs generally are pretty good about minimizing capital gain distributions. And this is the time of year that it's front and center for clients.
Yeah, no question about that. Now, in terms of this particular change, I mean, we've seen changes over time. What is your opinion on, was it well overdue? Is this something that was important? Or is it something like, okay, it's just a splitting up of a round? And what was the whole point of it?
Yeah, so actually, I do want to make one sort of clarification. Not all sector funds, sector-based funds, ETFs, mutual funds, or otherwise, track GICs.
Right.
So, you know, part of the education process here is clients understanding some tech funds do hold those names that you would sort of have seen prior to this change, will still continue to do so. So for example, at iShares, we have a couple U.S. domestic ETFs in the technology sector, IYW and IGM, that were not impacted by this change, and you will still find those tech giants in there. So, you know, one message I do want to put out to investors is, you know, not all ETFs were impacted, right? Not all ETFs.
It's only the ones, just to clarify that further, it's only the ETFs that had their benchmark or their tracking mechanism linked to this particular standardization.
Correct. Yeah. And GICS just happens to be one of the more heavily used. So that's why it was a big event. It was also a really well-telegraphed event. You know, the announcement was made a couple quarters ago. So from a trading perspective, from a market anticipation perspective, you know, it was really well-telegraphed. But going back to the root of your question, I think it was like, why the changes now and was this long overdue? And, you know, when you think about classifying companies when they start off and how things change in the economy, you know, the rationale for these changes have been, you know, some of the ways in which we communicate has fundamentally changed since GICS was created in 1999. So when you think about telecommunications and how we interact with each other and sort of compare what we were doing in 1999 with what we're doing here in 2018, you know, companies like Facebook and Google are more involved with our sort of communications in society than they are just a pure tech company. So part of the rationalization, you know, was trying to get better groupings, better sort of cohorts, if you will, of, you know, what these companies fundamentally do. And I think it's just a great reflection of the way in which we operate on our day-to-day has changed in the last 19, 20 years.
It's interesting because where is Amazon currently? What particular gig sector? Do you know?
So Amazon would be still in the consumer discretionary.
Which is interesting because this is a very clear discussion that tags on to what you were talking about on how changes and evolution of a company happens over time. But they are clearly in the retail and the consumer discretionary. There's no question about that, right? However, they're also in television/video/music. They also have their AWS, which is that's technology. That's not consumer discretionary, right? AWS. So this is kind of a company that doesn't necessarily fit that square so well.
Absolutely. I would agree with you. And, you know, companies today are more amorphic than they've been in the past. You know, they're transcending sector lines. And, you know, from a schema or from a taxonomy perspective, you're sort of lumped into one area. You know, this is where we look at, you know, funds that will sort of cast a wider net and try to, you know, look for companies that have expressions of technology, but maybe they're lumped into consumer discretionary. So let me give you an example. We have our fund, our S&P North American ETF, IGM. It's a technology-focused ETF. It actually holds all the FANG stocks, despite the fact that they're classified in different sectors, because it does understand that, you know, in the methodology that there's going to be certain companies that do have some technology bent to them, even though they might be classified as consumer discretionary or communications. So we've had a lot of clients ask us, you know, now that sort of some of the bigger names are breaking up from traditional tech funds, do you guys have an ETF that still holds the FANG stocks? And yes, we do. Right. So, you know, being able to sort of cast the net out and really think about, you know, is AWS, you know, the sort of the from Amazon technology bent? Absolutely. So, you know, there are different ways to get exposure today to companies that are more amorphic than just sort of sitting in one sector, if you will.
So now with all these changes that are going on and how we are seeing that there are these different classifications, a lot of funds will still be labeled tech ETFs, you know, blah, 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 technology fund or technology ETF, whatever. But there may be some significant differentials underlying the portfolios and how's that going to play out?
Yeah, so this is the right time for investors to take stock in what they own, because to your point, going forward, you're going to have a situation where you have two tech ETFs that say tech on the name, and they hold something fundamentally different. So if you think about year-to-date returns, Facebook's down about 10%, Google's up about 10%, Apple's up 30%. Now, if some of those companies are moving from one tech fund but will remain in the other, you're going to see big performance differences going forward. So I anticipate investors and our clients really taking a look when they see their statements and saying, why is this one performing so different than the other? And this will just create a further need for doing your homework and due diligence, because just because it says technology ETF doesn't necessarily mean that it owns the same name.
This happened in a big way. And I remember back in somewhere back in the mid-90s, when I was always talking about how you can't judge a book by its cover, and particularly with mutual funds, where there was a fund that was like the small cap fund. You know, the blank diddy blank small cap fund, right? And I look at the portfolio, I'm like, oh, where are the small caps? You know, I don't understand. And it wasn't like there was a couple of companies that just grew up and they never got rid of. It was just, you know, littered with large caps in there, or vice versa. And, you know, that's a problem. It's more so also when you're dealing with, I think, the idea that you want to have a portfolio that is specifically set to whatever particular asset allocation you have, and we're sticklers for this, and you don't want to have style drift. So all of a sudden you say, okay, in my portfolio, I want 5% in this sector or this style or whatever it may be, and people will just like take something off the shelf and say, well, that fits because that's what the name says. So just to bring this all the way back around, what you're saying now is, it makes some sense to look at the underlying, I guess, it makes sense that if you can, if you're looking at an ETF, look at what the benchmark and the index they're tracking are to make sure that you have the right one that you want in your portfolio. That's the best way to do this, right?
Absolutely. It's always best to do your homework. And I think one of the best value propositions of ETFs that goes underappreciated is how transparent they are. So if you go to iShares.com and you look up one of our technology funds, IGM, IYW, you can see exactly what names you own, and you can sort of make the decision whether you're comfortable with that or whether you want to look at an alternative technology ETF and figure out what it owns. But bottom line, the value of transparency is at its best when there's big differences between ETFs. It allows investors to make more informed decisions, and that's something that we really recommend and stand behind as a value proposition for ETFs.
Good stuff. Daniel Pritz, head of iShares Product Consulting at BlackRock, the number one ETF provider. I appreciate your time. Thanks so much for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you, Andrew.
All right, bye-bye. And up next is Patrick Camuso. He is a CPA, and he's the founder of Camuso CPA. And this firm is kind of a little bit different than some of the CPA firms that you probably know, where they kind of do a lot more in the client service model and take a bit more of an entrepreneurial approach to delivering clients service and attention in areas that maybe they don't really have experience before. But I thought, Patrick, why don't you tell me and explain to my audience exactly what you do before we get into some of the meat of the topics?
Yeah, absolutely. So we're a full-service CPA firm based in the Charlotte, North Carolina area, although we do work with clients nationwide. We work with clients on saving money, time, and peace of mind. So we provide tax services, both tax preparation services and tax planning services for investors and small businesses. So we know we work very heavily with both cryptocurrency investors and real estate investors, as well as all types of small businesses.
So the cryptocurrency investors is obviously a more... It's a newer area for you. It's a newer absolutely, it's a newer area for everybody in this world of taxation, right?
Yeah. The way that I sort of found our firm sort of out ahead of this trend and ahead of this opportunity was, you know, I was investing in the crypto space myself, and just being a CPA and a CPA firm owner that was already working with mainly real estate investors at that time, we started to get a lot of questions from first people within my network and then sort of, you know, second and third degree connections from people that knew other investors. And, you know, we realized there's a lot of misinformation out there. There's a lot of gray area in the tax code, and it's, you know, been a great addition in terms of the service lines that we're able to provide.
So one of the things that I want to do, the reason why I want to have you on now was because we're getting towards that time of the year. It's the last quarter of 2018. And here are a lot of people with, probably a lot of questions because we had this new change to the tax code, right? A big change to a variety of areas. A lot on the corporate side, of course, some on the individual side. But I thought maybe it would be kind of an interesting time to, you know, give people a heads up that, hey, you need to start paying attention to some of this stuff now because it will make your life a lot easier going into the time when you're actually going to file. So why don't we start off with a discussion of some of the new tax codes, the new tax laws, the new variations involved with small and large businesses and individuals, and some tips that people need to know about.
Absolutely. So like you said, you know, these are huge tax cuts that got passed just this past December. So CPAs, taxpayers, even the IRS are still unraveling the implications of all of these changes. And you know, what our firm is doing right now is working very heavily with both small businesses and individuals on working to plan for these. So anyone that's a small business owner or even an individual investor should definitely be proactive about planning for these. You know, these are the biggest tax cuts to take place in like the last 40 or 50 years. So, you know, at a high level, and you can imagine the level of changes and detail that go into these. So there's a few high level things that I think are very important to point out to business owners and are sort of driving the preliminary conversations that we have with both existing clients and new clients coming to the firm. And so, you know, I'm happy to highlight those for you.
Yeah.
So at the corporate level, in terms of C corporations, that's sort of the biggest change or the biggest perceived change in the tax code. It's sort of what was branded for these tax cuts is the 21% corporate tax rate across the board for all corporations. Something that a lot of taxpayers are less aware of is another provision in these tax law changes, specifically Section 199A, that allows tax cuts for non-corporate taxpayers as well. So, you know, if you have a pass-through entity such as an S corporation, partnership, et cetera, there's still opportunities for you to realize some very large tax savings depending on the facts and circumstances of your business. So the first step that we take with any client, and again, whether they're an existing client or a new client, is assessing or reassessing whether or not they're in the correct type of entity for the business that they're doing.
Well, that's a good point. Also, because let me just, I was pretty excited. I'm like, oh, we're a subchapter S corporation over here. We got some LLCs that are designed under, the same kind of thing. But when you read down and you get the final verdict, it seems that financial advisors, I think CPAs also, are not going to get the great benefits of some of these tax cuts.
Yeah. CPAs definitely are not getting any of the benefits of the tax cuts, and many other professional service firms also are going to be excluded from that. That's something that, you definitely want to look at on a business-to-business basis to first see if you even qualify for Section 199A at all. Even in addition to that, there's additional phase-outs for this. If you're making over certain amounts of income, that deduction, that 20% deduction, starts to get phased out. So the tax deductions for the pass-throughs are very limited. They're much less limited on the corporate side.
So now, does it make sense? Let me interrupt you here. Does it make sense for some possible sub-S corporations to convert to Cs?
Possibly. Now, there's a lot of considerations that go into that. First and foremost, like, what's the nature of the business? What type of assets are you holding in the business? Potentially if you're holding a lot of low-cost basis assets in an S corporation and you do convert to a C corporation, that's one potential tax exposure we would have to consider. Mm-hmm. Just overall looking at whether or not you should shift from an S corp to a C corp, we also want to consider what's your expected use of your after tax dollars.
Right.
Are you going to be holding on to a lot of this and exposed to those two layers of tax in a C corporation? Or is your business, in a growth phase and you're spending a lot of these dollars right now? So you'll be able to sort of enjoy this tax rate and not get any of the negative blowback.
Right.
So, you can see how it gets very situational. Even if you're in the same industry vertical, given your facts and circumstances, the level of business that you're doing, where exactly you're at, the ultimate decision that we arrive at for you can be very different.
Right. But let's just skip over, because I know a lot of the listeners probably have, there's a lot of listeners who probably do have corporate entities that they're involved in, or businesses, let's say, but a lot of them probably, well, everybody on top of that has the individual tax side as well, right? So
absolutely.
What are the biggest things that we can, the benefits for us that we should be maybe looking out for towards the end of the year that could benefit us into next year? Because remember, something about taxes that everybody has to remember, right? If you don't do it by December 31st, whatever it is that you were going to do, it's over. You can't get it back. You can't go retroactively. So
unfortunately, in most circumstances, you cannot go back for taxes. So, you do have to be very, very proactive in all the planning that you do.
So what's the story? What's some of the things that individuals need to be looking at for the end of the year 2018?
Well, generally speaking, when I'm working with any individual, first I want to make sure that from a tax perspective, we're running a projection for them. If there's an opportunity for them to make any types of retirement contributions, any HSA contributions, that's going to get them a nice tax deduction right off the bat. After that, it's going to get very situational from the personal perspective. And what I generally recommend is that, we do a detailed tax projection. And we get down to your specific facts and circumstances, because there's a lot of changes in terms of, what can be taken as deductions versus what cannot be taken as deductions.
Right.
And, it gets very situational at that personal level.
And this year, well, first of all, let's both probably agree on this, that any income that you make on a worldwide basis as a U.S. citizen, you're required to report. That's simple, right?
Absolutely.
That's a simple.
Absolutely.
Simple. But sometimes there are some people that, there's certain income streams that they may, well, say, well, you know, I sold something on eBay or, you know, I made a trade for something. Okay, so I get that, right? That's mm-hmm. under the table kind of stuff. However, cryptocurrencies and trading in cryptocurrencies, if there are any gains these days or losses for that matter, if you want to pass that through, a lot of people viewed that for a long time as, well, it's cryptocurrencies. There's no 1099s issued, right? There's, well, for the most part. And how what are the rules with that?
Well, there are rules. And, you know, the first thing I want to stress is there definitely are rules. And anybody that is trading cryptocurrencies needs to be aware of them because they are liable for taxes if they're trading them. In terms of the issuing 1099s, I think that's a great starting point to discuss about, you know, why are people going to report and are they going to be more compliant in the future? I think my answer to that question would be yes, because we do see companies like Coinbase, even Gemini and Bittrex starting to issue 1099s to their investors that are transacting above certain thresholds on their exchanges. So I think going forward, we're going to continue to see 1099s get issued as we see these cryptocurrency exchanges become more compliant. You know, they've been operating in a gray area themselves for some time, so tax reporting hasn't been a major concern for them. But going forward, as you know, they continue to work with regulators, tax reporting is going to be something that is as common as when you're in the stock market to when you're in the cryptocurrency market.
But make no mistake though, that even if you don't get a 1099, that does not mean that you're exempt.
No, not at all.
It just means you didn't get a 1099.
Exactly. You were on the hook for all of those trades, and it's, you know, as a taxpayer, it's your responsibility to be tracking and reconciling all those trades accurately. So, you know, that's something that we work with investors on, is helping them get their data from all the various exchanges that they're trading on, compiling that data, and then analyzing it from a tax perspective accurately, and then reporting it on their tax return. So, you know, it's something that a lot of investors, like you said, have been since, you know, 2014 is when the first IRS guidance came out for cryptocurrencies, but it was very broad and it left a lot of investors in a gray area. You know, since then, there hasn't really been that much additional guidance. So investors have been a little loose with their reporting from what, you know, you can read on the internet. Now, what I can say is any investor that comes to our firm is first and foremost focused on protecting their assets. So we take a very conservative approach to how we report the cryptocurrency trades for investors.
I mean, what about wash sales? Are the same rules for cryptocurrencies as we've seen for stocks in terms of short-term holding periods, long-term holding periods, wash sales, things of that nature?
Wash sales is a very good and interesting question. So cryptocurrencies is a new asset class that's developing. And, you know, you see the CFTC looking hard at crypto, the IRS, obviously, along with the SEC. And most of these regulatory bodies, unfortunately, aren't in alignment to what type of asset a cryptocurrency actually is. From the IRS perspective, right now it's being treated as property. You know, depending on who you talk to, in other regulatory bodies, it may be a commodity, it may be a security. From an IRS perspective, right now, it's treated as property. So wash sales are something that can be effectively argued is an acceptable position on your tax return. It is slightly aggressive, since you know, many of these cryptocurrencies in the future may get treated as securities. But for the time being right now, from an IRS perspective, since none of these assets are being treated as securities, then wash sales rules actually don't apply to them.
It's only a matter of time, in my opinion. It is a security, for goodness sakes.
I mean, you know, we have seen some indications with some just passing comments, obviously, from the SEC that Bitcoin and Ethereum may or may not be decentralized enough to not be treated as a security. So, you know, you can feel a little more comfortable taking that position on that tax return. But I think even in the future, if the IRS, you know, does treat them as securities based off of what happens in the future, I do not think that's going to be retroactive. So that's why, you know, wash sales, although they're in a gray area and they're slightly aggressive, that is a position that we do recommend to clients on a case-by-case basis, you know, after we discuss the facts and circumstances with them. So, you know, that's one gray area. Another implication to cryptocurrencies being taxed as properties is like-kind exchanges. Mm. So, you know,
one into another? Are you talking about like from one exchange to another, or are you talking about from one coin to another?
From one coin to another. So unfortunately, you know, especially before 2017, a lot of investors thought only if you go from crypto to cash, it's a taxable event. And they were doing this under the pretense that like-kind exchanges apply to all cryptocurrencies.
So let me just interrupt you for a second. So you're talking about, for example, converting dollars into Ethereum, buying Ethereum against, let's say, you know, ABC coin, and therefore it would be, and back then selling it, making some money back to Ethereum. And until you actually cashed your Ethereum out, that would not, people didn't think that was considered an actual profit. It was more of a like-kind exchange.
Exactly. So, you know, basically the IRS in 2014, they said cryptocurrencies are taxed as property. Since then, they didn't give any further guidance. So investors have been in the dark on 1031 exchanges. But what the IRS never did was explicitly say that like-kind exchanges are permitted, and there's never been any tax court cases to indicate that that would be the case. So there's no substantial authority to allow us to take that position on a tax return. So it's not correct to be filing for like-kind exchanges. And, you know, for crypto investors, that it's sort of the wild, wild west. They unfortunately thought that, you know, when they were trading during 2017, during this market appreciation, they thought that all of these trades weren't going to be taxable, when in fact they were taxable.
Hmm,
so it was a big surprise to many investors. You know, there's a lot of active traders in the crypto market that were trading, you know, when Bitcoin was appreciating up to 20K and holding their profits in Bitcoin. So they had all these paper gains. And then as the market takes a hit, they're still on the hook for those trades. Hmm. So it definitely is imperative for, you know, before you get into investing in any type of asset class, you need to know the rules of the game, and you need to know how taxes apply to your portfolio.
Interesting stuff. Let's switch over now to this, the SALT cap, the state and local taxes. There's some loophole that's being discussed recently.
Yeah,
by using a charitable contribution, and what is the story with this?
Yeah, so I thought that was a pretty interesting and creative tax planning strategy that you know was being proposed. Unfortunately, that's not something that's going to be permitted or that's going to work in the future. Basically, what happened was, as a result again of these tax cuts and tax changes that took place late December, December 22nd, 2017. One of the big things that were changed on the personal tax side was state and local taxes used to be able to be deducted. Any state and local taxes that you paid used to be deducted on your Schedule A. Now you can only deduct $10,000 of these taxes. Mm-hmm. So, you know, especially for people that are living in states like California or New York, this is going to have a huge impact on their tax liability, and it's obviously going to increase their tax liability. So CPAs and these taxpayers, as well as even the state tax agencies, were looking at ways to mitigate this negative impact. And what they came up with was, at the state level, certain qualified charities that would be qualified by the state taxation agencies, these taxpayers could contribute to, and they would get a state tax credit. So basically, rather than paying state taxes, you would just contribute your state taxes to a local charity. That money would theoretically get moved throughout your local economy and still benefit your community, but you would get a state tax deduction. And the reason that they want to do that is because at the federal level, there's no restriction against taking charitable deductions on your Schedule A. So they would be giving this deduction back to these taxpayers, basically. And it would have worked, but there's actually new provisions that got added to the regulations that prevent this from happening.
So wait, was the money going to the charity and the charity would pay your taxes?
No, the money would go to the charity and the state the state tax, whatever state that you're in, say you're in New York, and New York has, and New York had this rule in place, you give the money to the charity, and then on your state tax return, they would give you a state tax credit for that.
But so that could always be done, right? It's not something new. You have done this 5 years ago.
Not at the state level.
Oh, so you're telling me that this is a loophole and the state's going to close it down?
Well, the state didn't close it down. The feds closed it down.
Oh, gotcha.
Because what they came back and said was any payment that's made to a state charity that a taxpayer receives a credit for has to get at it back. The taxes. They can't take it as a deduction.
Yeah. So that's all done.
They're trying.
Listen, they tried to do, you know, double payments also, you know, advance payments. That was kind of whacked out too. So
yeah, that one I wouldn't have recommended either. Unfortunately, I didn't think that one would go well, but they did try that as well. So, you know, these, like I said, these tax changes are huge. So every CPA, every taxing authority, every taxpayer is taking a hard look at these from all angles, and it impacts everybody differently. This one was very negative for anyone in some of these higher tax states. And unfortunately, you know, personally, our firm has not found a really good way to mitigate this. Just looking at this one isolated fact pattern here.
Well, and that was the goal, of course, of the government to try to, you know, well, there was a lot of goals in this whole idea, it seems. You know, if you look at the state and the political sense of it, there were some reasons why possibly this was done. And it's also obviously the government's trying to get back a little bit from the other side where they gave so much to the corporations. They got to, you know, tax receipts, we just did a report. Tax receipts have fell dramatically over the last 6 months.
Absolutely. And, you know, the salt taxes with this being capped is projected to be very beneficial and from a federal tax revenue standpoint.
Interesting. Well, listen, I'm going to make sure that your information is over on the website. Show notes for episode number 582 over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com, where you can find out more information and get in touch with Patrick if you have any questions, want to get some insight into some of these things, whether it's cryptocurrency, corporate work, maybe some of the salt tax or otherwise. So I appreciate you coming on the show and sharing some of your wisdom today.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I appreciate you having me on. Thanks again.
All right, Patrick, we'll talk soon. Thanks. That's going to wrap it up for this show. There's a lot of interesting information, a lot of information there. I mean, obviously, we have to know about what's happening with the whole area of those global industry classification standard changes and how it impacts us. Well, I think we learned a little bit about that. There's a lot of reading out there. So do your homework in this area because there is a lot that really needs to be looked at when considering investing in sectors. So make sure that you, if you are a sector investor, if that's your preference, or even if you have some sector funds inside of your portfolio, ETFs, mutual funds, et cetera, make sure they're investing the way that you want to be investing. And it's not just by name alone. In other words, it's not just the name of the ETF or the mutual fund that you're looking at when it comes to what you're buying. So if it says it's the ABC Technology Fund, make sure it really is tracking the specific index that you want it to track, that you want it to follow, that you want to emulate, especially with all these changes that have recently come into play. And of course, the discussion with Patrick recently, just a moment ago, where we talked about taxes, I thought it was really interesting. One of the takeaways that I got was the whole area of crypto and how there's confusion about the taxation of gains and whether or not you're going to be liable for some things that you may not have thought that you were going to be. So watch your mailbox and contact your custodian, whoever is holding your coins, if you have some, and make sure that you understand what the tax ramifications are for any of those transactions that you made. Finally, I'll mention something over on investology.com. ENVESTOLOGY, Investology. If you want to check out our offering that we created this really cool, I mean, this really, I think what's really cool about it is it doesn't seem that complex from the front end, but when we really look at how this all operates, in terms of the scoring of your answers and placing you in a specific risk tolerance and a appropriate time horizon style, and then matching that with a portfolio that we build and monitor and invest in for you behind the scenes here. It's, I think, one of the better ways of going about automated, quote unquote, robo, quote unquote, style, bit of a hybrid. It's a hybrid because basically we're using some of the components, the tools, and the automation capability of robo, but yet we're doing the investing. That's why we call it advisor crafted, technology enhanced investing. So it's kind of, we craft the portfolios, but we use some technology behind the scenes. The nice thing is you asked for this, so we did it. It's $10,000 minimum. It has a classical diversification that we create using some of the top funds that we could find and ETFs in the area of whatever particular sector slash style slash asset allocation that we're investing for you. Anyway, bottom line, you can check it out. All you have to do is go over to investology.com. There's a button somewhere that says check out my portfolio or client login. All you have to do is just set up a registration and very simply start creating a portfolio. If you're happy, if you want to continue on, if you think it's what you want to do and you want to invest money, well, just go along and open an account over TD Ameritrade through the process, et cetera. Otherwise, you could at least see where this lays out for the style of your investment. You can see how we would potentially invest and what asset allocation we would model for your particular risk tolerance and time horizon. Really cool stuff. Go check it out if you haven't done so. I think you really like what you'll see. Investology.com. You can find out all the information about how we invest, the styles that we manage, et cetera, over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Just see what's going on. Of course, be there or be square. Tuesday nights, 9 o'clock, when I talk with John C. Dvorak live at 9 o'clock on DH Unplugged. Really good information discussed there as well. Really taking apart the news, putting it back together, looking at all the different angles of the business news and what's happening with markets. That's also available on iTunes and everywhere else that you want to take a look. But otherwise, I will see you next week when we have another great guest coming up. So have a great week. Have a successful week. Have a profitable week. I'll see you then.
The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.